podcast exploring the stories of people who cook from the heart, inspired by my nanny who taught me what cooking for love meant. I'm Kate Mobley, and this week I'll be chatting to Pippa Wilkinson.
Hello.
Pippa is a lawyer in Manchester and a self-taught home cook. She runs the Instagram account My Kitchen Year, where she posts her meals and meal plans. She's not cooked the same meal since 2009, which is pretty impressive. Pippa, like me, loves using seasonal crops in cooking and absolutely hates food waste, so likes to use leftovers imaginatively. She has her own allotment, which she has had for 13 years, and I'm always endlessly envious and impressed by the bounty that comes from it. As well as cooking, Pippa is also a great baker, regularly making great sourdough and beautiful celebration cakes for family and friends. You should check out her cakes on her Instagram. They're pretty impressive, especially the Peppa Pig one. Looked very gorgeous.
That was a favourite.
So without further ado, Pippa, welcome to Cooking for Love.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good.
Good. So I always kick things off by asking people, what's something you cooked recently that excited you?
Well, I think it's probably an old cliche, but I made an amazing roast chicken last week. The sort of amazing roast chicken where I had it in mind for a dish later in the day. So I'd been prepared and roasted it earlier in the day and then spent all afternoon going back into the kitchen thinking, I'll just have a little bit. I'll just test another little bit. Just in case it wasn't good, which I knew it was always going to be good. And by the end of the afternoon, I'd eaten sort of almost half of this chicken. And I love a roast chicken with the crispy skin, some grain salt on the on the skin, and slightly warm from the oven, but not hot. I loved it. And I genuinely think that would be sort of the death row meal for me, like a crispy roast chicken. I could stand at the counter in the kitchen and just almost mindlessly eat it all to myself.
I could definitely do that, and that would be my idea of heaven. I just love a roast chicken too, like just simple. Obviously I love like harissa and lemon chicken and all the kind of thing, but just a classic roast chicken is...
And it smelt amazing as it was cooking during the day, because I'd been out for a walk whilst it was in the oven. I came back to that delicious smell. And I took it out of the oven. I thought, oh, that looks really good. And I kept going back and looking at it. And I thought, well, I'll just slice a piece. And I had a piece. And then, of course, once I'd had that crispy skin, I had to keep going back. And then I was thinking, I'm actually going to end up eating this whole chicken and not have it for the dish that I planned it for. But yeah, that was pretty exciting.
What's your favourite bit of the chicken?
I think from a roast chicken, I would have the chicken breast with the crispy skin over it. But I think for almost any other chicken dish, I would say the thigh.
Yeah.
Because I think just the... You can't beat the flavour, the fattiness it adds to the dish. But yeah, I think for a roast chicken, I think that's probably nostalgic because that was always the bit that I would get. I would always get the chicken breast on the roast chicken when I was a child. So I think that's why I probably prefer that in a roast chicken. But yeah, I love a crispy chicken thigh or a fried chicken thigh.
That sounds good.
Essentially, I love chicken.
Yeah. I'm glad we've established that early.
Yes, yes. Sorry to the vegetarians and the vegans.
I also love chicken. I think... Yeah, I would always go for the leg, but like if I'm picking the chicken, the oyster is so good.
I always say to people, if you are roasting a chicken and you're picking it for using the meat in other things, don't forget to turn it upside down because there's so many great bits of chicken there that are so juicy and moist.
Yeah, because they're at the bottom.
I know.
Get all the...
Yeah, and then the sort of joy continued because I made a delicious stock and I sort of kept thinking, oh, it's done now. No, I'll reduce it more, reduce it more. So it's such a rich stock. And it was so delicious that I ended up drinking about three bowls of it with a teaspoon of white miso stirred through it. And it was just so savoury and warming and delicious.
Very nourishing.
Really, yeah. So I think a roast chicken, it just would fix everything. So I would always be excited if I knew that it was roast chicken, either in my oven or on the menu somewhere.
Oh, that was a good one. I want roast chicken.
Sorry, I've made you really hungry now.
It's kind of a byproduct of the podcast.
Yes, I know. Yeah, it should come with a warning. Don't listen to or record it whilst hungry.
mine is, we had, I was telling you just before, we had Burns night at our house last night, and even though I've made haggis and eats and tatties numerous times, I haven't had made it for that many people in a long time. So
is it vat? vat
of mash, vat of neeps and carrots. And we had haggis from Littlewoods and nice veggie haggis as well.
Oh, delicious.
So yeah. And whiskey sauce, obviously.
I think neeps and tatties, or neeps and carrots, I think people don't have them enough throughout the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I think quite a few people now would have something like that at Christmas maybe,
mm-hmm.
and of course at Burns Night. And I think, why don't people have that more often, like with your Sunday roast? Because it is so good.
It is lovely. Yeah, it was fun. And then we had cranachan for pudding.
Oh, delicious.
And I did, my friend Chloe's got a really good recipe where she makes flapjack instead of having the oats in it.
Oh, now that's next level,
isn't it? And then she puts mascarpone through the cream, and it's
See, that is another dish as well that I think, whilst you're making it, or once you've made it, and perhaps it's in the fridge, is very difficult not to keep testing a little bit of.
I made a lot of extra flapjack, that was easy.
Yeah, had to make a whole batch of flapjack just to crumble up the equivalent of one into the cranachan.
Yeah. I was like, oh, maybe someone might be lactose intolerant, so I should make some extra flapjack for on the side.
Oh, amazing.
And then didn't make it.
No. I don't think I trust a cook who doesn't sample things as they go along.
True.
Either out of testing it for seasoning and things like that, or just out of greed.
Yeah.
Which I'm definitely in the latter.
Yes. Well, yeah, both.
Yeah.
You mentioned to me before that you used to be a fussy eater.
Yes, I've so had a bit
growing
of a,
up for you.
Yeah, a really fussy eater. It's a checkered past, really, with food. So I'm always surprised, and my family are always surprised, how much I enjoy food, and that's not just cooking, but eating it now. I was a really fussy eater as a child. I mean, my mum regales other people with the stories of how when she would make a sausage casserole with, you see, I'm a child of the 80s, so it would be the classic Schwartz packet mix casserole mix, and she would put sausages and onions and things like that in there. And I was so fussy that she would, once she'd baked the casserole, have to take out the sausages that I would be eating and wipe the sauce off them so that I would have effectively plain nude sausages that I could put ketchup on the side of, and I would be perfectly happy. And that was her nod to, well, I'm not going to cook a separate meal for you because I'm not going to bow that much to the fussiness, but I will make sure that you'll eat it. But I was so fussy that my first word was cheesy because I ate so many Watsits. Because I would eat nothing else. And I think my mum, after sort of months and months of trying to persuade me to be more adventurous with my diet, just got to the stage of thinking, well, if she's had anything, I know that if she's had something, even if it's cheesy Watsits, at least I know she's not going to starve.
Yeah.
But it became so bad that instead of saying mummy or daddy, that I said cheesies. So, but that continued, really. I mean, not just eating cheesy Watsits, because I think I'd probably get scurvy, wouldn't I, if I'd only eaten that. But that continued until I was probably about maybe 11 or 12, that really limited sort of being quite fussy, not very adventurous at all. And then I suppose in my teenage years, I wasn't really any more adventurous, but I think probably the meals that my mum would cook at home, I was able to eat more of them in the way that the rest of my family would eat them without any sort of special adjustments for me. But even then, I suppose, again, as a child of the 80s, my mum wasn't cooking anything really out there in terms of flavour or textures. And so I got familiar and, in my mind, safe with the meals that she was cooking me.
Yeah.
And so I suppose, looking back, I probably was still fussy, but I was at least eating... sort of healthy home-cooked food that was nourishing enough so that I didn't get scurvy. But yeah, really fussy, really fussy.
Was food like quite a big thing in your family growing up?
No, really not. I mean, my dad was the sort of eat for fuel type person.
Right.
I mean, equally, he would sit and eat whatever he was given, and my brother very much followed that pattern. Liked to eat a lot and would eat whatever was put in front of him. But I think my mum found cooking for a family of four probably quite stressful. I don't think she was somebody who enjoyed cooking. And I think because, like, as a family of four, she probably didn't ever have time to cook in what she thought was an enjoyable way, that it was always just, you know, get tea on the table rather than, oh, there's something new that I might want to try, or a recipe that I've seen. So she very much had a repertoire of probably maybe 8 or 9 dishes that she knew that we would all eat, that she could get on the table quickly and that would fill us all up. And none of them were particularly adventurous or, you know, things like fresh garlic she wouldn't ever have used. Again, child of the 80s, so maybe like this was common in a lot of households, but fresh garlic or fresh ginger or herbs, and probably spices, like quite alien to her in terms of her cooking. So I did enjoy what I ate that she cooked, but I wasn't ever from a household where, you know, I didn't stand alongside her and cook. You know, she didn't teach me how to make certain recipes. In fact, I was just thinking the other day, actually, knowing that we were going to chat about this, that I think one of the favourite dishes that she used to make, apart from a roast, because I think that's where my love of roast chicken came from, was...
That's always such a treat.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it, in our household, it was always, on a Sunday, it would always be a roast. And it would always be chicken, because that was the affordable roast back then. And she would make this dish that she just called chicken and rice. And I was thinking about it the other day, and I genuinely just think it was chicken piece, like cut into pieces, perhaps some onions, cooked in a condensed mushroom soup and sweet corn added and served on rice. And I loved it. And to me, that probably was quite an exotic dinner, not knowing what had gone into it. But it felt sort of, oh, this is quite interesting and different. And actually, when I think about it, it was probably about those four ingredients.
Yeah.
So it was home cooked, but it was simple home cooking. And she'd make the same mix and put it in like ready-made vol-au-vent cases.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And that was, I thought the vol-au-vent was like the height of food sophistication.
Very fancy. Yeah.
If there was ever a buffet that had vol-au-vents, I would be...
You're in the right place. Yeah.
I would be in front of the vol-au-vent tray repeatedly.
Have you made the chicken and rice since yourself?
No, and this was why I was thinking about it, that I thought to myself, I wonder why I haven't ever made it. And I think if I asked my mum how to make it, she would say, oh, you know, you just bung some chicken and some sweet corn into a tin of condensed mushroom soup, which was so odd because actually I was a child who wouldn't have eaten mushroom soup. So I think if I'd known it was mushroom soup, I wouldn't have eaten it. And if she served me just the tin of mushroom soup, I wouldn't have eaten it. But put together like that, I thought it was delicious.
I wonder if, like, if you tried to make a fancy version of it without the tin soup and like made it, I wonder if it would taste the same. It probably wouldn't.
I think that would ruin it. I think it would ruin it. And I probably haven't had it since I was maybe 11. So maybe my memory of it is better than the actual eating of it, the reality of it, if I made it now. But yeah, that to me was just a really delicious family meal that she would make. Probably once a week.
Sounds good.
I mean, we weren't ever a family who, like, oh, Tuesdays were this meal and Wednesdays were this meal, but we, because she had this repertoire of maybe sort of 8 or 9 dishes, there was this regularity to the things that we were eating. So yeah, chicken and rice would always be welcomed by all of us.
Nice. So if you're not really a foodie family, when did you start to get into it and start to...
I mean, I think it was necessity really when I went to university, and very quickly I realised if I didn't cook for myself that those 3 years would be some pretty dull and uninteresting eating. And I was still quite fussy to the point where, because I wasn't doing cooking at home before I left for university, even the thought of holding raw meat to prepare a dish would freak me out. But I thought to myself, well, you know, I could be vegetarian. But I did like eating meat. It was just the not having somebody to prepare it that was the problem. And so I thought to myself, I'm going to have to just do this. And I remember buying a copy of Delicious magazine. And that was probably after I'd graduated. That was maybe after I'd graduated. I think sort of during university, I was probably relying on a lot of pasta and pesto, although I'd be making my own pesto, so I was gradually sort of straying into making things myself. And I'd cook, you know, like a piece of chicken and have it with potatoes. So it's fairly simple stuff, but at least I was making things myself. Mm. And then I think it was just through reading, like food magazines. I couldn't really afford cookery books at that stage. But so like a monthly food magazine would keep me going and open my eyes really to spices, like cooking things in a different way that I hadn't experienced at home or cooked for myself at that stage. I just became really interested. And the more I read and the more I made, mm-hmm. the more it sort of fueled this fire in me.
Yeah.
And actually I realised, because I think I'd always thought that you needed to be taught how to cook.
Mm-hmm. And that because there is that misconception.
Yeah, and that because I hadn't had anybody to teach me how to cook, that maybe it was beyond me, or, you know, I had to slavishly follow a recipe, and that if I didn't have a recipe, I wouldn't know what to do. But actually, I then started to realise that for a lot of dishes, like a recipe can be a starting point if you don't know what you're doing. But then there's so many different ways mm-hmm. that you can take dishes or adapt to what you've got in, that then I started to realise actually you can be a cook who's intuitive, who hasn't ever been taught, oh, you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way. Mm-hmm. And in some ways that was really helpful, because I think I'm quite rule-based normally in the rest of my life. So I think if I had been taught, oh, you have to do things this way, I wouldn't feel like I had that freedom to experiment in the way that I did. But because I'd never been told that there were any rules to follow, I just went with it, really. And I've never stopped really since then.
Because there's definitely a difference between learning to cook because you have to, and then becoming a so-called foodie.
Yeah, exactly.
Where we both have Instagram accounts and love to eat and talk endlessly about food.
Exactly. Exactly. I think I realised how much I'd been missing in a way. And I don't say that in any sort of criticism of like my mum or the relationship with food I had growing up. Mm-hmm. But I think I realised how much I enjoyed not only the eating but the preparing, mm-hmm. and then I became a feeder.
Yeah.
I realised that everybody else could get joy from the things that I would make them.
Yeah.
And I think that was just this sort of circularity of me thriving off that feeling of joy that you get from either feeding yourself well or feeding somebody else mm-hmm. well, and then wanting to do that more, and so wanting to learn more and read more and do more. Mm. So yeah, I just, and then it almost became this feeling of, well, I've spent my childhood and my early adulthood not eating adventurously mm-hmm. or eating like a wide variety of things, and now I've got this sort of almost time limit of the rest of my life to have these delicious meals, mm-hmm. and so if I don't cook something different regularly, all those things that I might miss out on and never have eaten by the time I get to my old age. And I mean
you do pretty well, so you have a different meal each week.
Yeah.
And so how do you go about, you said you also like planning it.
Yes.
And that is fun. I do love planning.
Yeah.
But what's your like process? Do you sit down every week and kind of think?
So
do you have loads of recipe books?
Yes. I mean, I think anybody who knows me knows that if they need to get me something as a present, they can't ever really go wrong with a cookery book. Mm-hmm. I have quite a large collection of cookery books, but I actually use them because, you know, I know quite a lot of people who have, and cookery books, you know, often they are beautiful and they're beautiful writing, and so, you know, some people might read them as a piece of prose, mm-hmm. but I think it's such a waste to have lots of cookery books and not actually use them, mm-hmm. and so I do like reading cookery books both for ideas and for recipes to cook. But I suppose my process of planning is really just thinking about things that I've seen either in books or magazines or on Instagram. That's a really great source of inspiration. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about, well, if I buy those ingredients for that meal, what might I have left over and what other meals can I make from mm-hmm. those ingredients? And trying to sort of balance that, you know, not eating too much meat, eating seasonally, getting some vegetarian and vegan meals in there. And I really just enjoy the process. Like I don't necessarily sit down weekly, because sometimes if I sit down for you know, a bit of a meal planning moment, I'll end up with several weeks worth of food.
Yeah.
But I'm always flexible with that. Like I'm not rigid to, oh, I've seen this recipe or I've got this idea for this dish I want to make, and therefore we're going to be having that on Tuesday night, you know.
In 3 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's always flexible, and yeah, so it's a bit of an organic process. I don't sort of force myself to sit down every week to do it, but I do it because I enjoy it. I think if I felt it was a chore, I probably wouldn't be as varied in terms of the meals that I eat.
Oh, you must have like such good repertoire of skills now.
I think the thing is though that you realise that so many skills work for so many different dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, if you think to like the Ready Steady Cook challenge of like a mystery bag of ingredients, what could you do with these ingredients?
Mm-hmm.
So many dishes that you'll have cooked before will give you the skills or the knowledge of how to use other ingredients or how to make other dishes. Yeah. And I think if you start from the point of view of balancing flavours, I don't think you can really go wrong. I think in any dish, whether it's got meat in it, vegetables in it, that if you start off with like textural differences, you want something crunchy, you want something soft, you want sweet, sour, hot, spicy, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
I think you can make a meal just from that as your starting point if you've got a good base level of ingredients, and then, you know, you can take it in any direction. Yeah. I just get excited by that sort of variety of things.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any failures?
Oh gosh, yes.
What's on your
not a lot, and that's the reason why that sort of that it, I can remember exactly the dish because there haven't been many failures. There's obviously been some dishes where perhaps the idea that I had in my mind of them and the excitement that I had to eat them hasn't necessarily been brought out when I got the dish in front of me, and it hasn't worked out quite how I wanted it to, or looked how I wanted it to. Sometimes. Yeah. Presentation can be
or it
an
looks
issue.
Different to what the book looks like, and it's like there's a food stylist making that. Okay.
But there was definitely one dish that was, I think, a resounding failure. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a failure probably because it was at a time where I didn't have the confidence to use my intuition. I could have saved it, but I think I didn't, because I thought, oh well, this is what this dish is supposed to be like.
Yeah.
And so it was it was a dish that, actually, looking back, is probably quite simple. It was a pasta dish with aubergine and butternut squash, and it had this sort of Romesco-style sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I could probably whip up something like that now that would
taste
delicious.
Without even thinking, yeah.
Yes, exactly. But I was following a recipe, and I think it probably would have been from Delicious Magazine. So, sorry, Delicious, the failure was mine, not yours. And I'd followed the recipe, and it was a recipe that took quite a long time. And this was quite early on in my cooking sort of experiments. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like it had taken quite a long time. And I felt like that anticipation was building up for how delicious this dish was going to be. And was it going to be worth the effort? And it was just the blandest dish.
Oh no.
It just tasted almost of nothing. Now, obviously, if I made a dish now that tasted of nothing, I would be doing all sorts of things to change it to make it into an amazing dish.
Mm-hmm.
But I...
Because you've got the backbone of something good there.
Yeah, exactly. But it just didn't occur to me, I think, because I wasn't yet at that stage of feeling confident in my using my intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And probably didn't have as many ingredients to hand to maybe transform it into something else.
Oh, I'm going to bung a whole lot of chilli flakes and salt into this.
And we both ate it, and, you know, that sort of 5 minutes of sort of eating and nobody saying anything, which is never a good sign, I think.
Sometimes it's either really good.
Yeah, I mean, if there were appreciative noises, then you think, okay, this is good. This is good that nobody said anything because they're just so busy enjoying it. But no, this was both of us thinking, this is pretty not great, and not wanting to be the one to say it. And so about 5 minutes in, we looked at each other and admitted that, yeah, this isn't very nice, is it? And I don't actually think we finished the dish, which is really unusual for us.
Okay.
But yeah, I now look back and I think, you idiot, why did you sit and eat that dish that you didn't enjoy because you thought that was how it was supposed to be, instead of fixing it?
Yeah.
But that wasn't the sort
like
of
maybe
cook
you hadn't
I was.
Salted the pasta water or like not put enough salt in throughout or
yeah, I mean, I th- yeah.
There's so many things.
Even now, I think a whack of salt and probably some butter to emulsify the sauce and maybe like you know, more parmesan to serve it with. All sorts of things that I could have done, but at the time it was just, and I felt so disappointed. Disappointed in the recipe, disappointed in myself, like I'd somehow failed in not being able to bring this dish into fruition. And just really defeated because of the length of time it had taken.
That's annoying,
what a letdown. Yeah. But yeah, that, I mean, there's that and a monkfish dish that that I actually thought was okay, but Neil thought was awful. And I think it was just that textural thing with monkfish. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite different to a lot of other white fish that you might have eaten.
It's quite meaty, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But apart from those two, I don't think there's been any failures that really stick in the mind.
Well, I mean, considering you cook new things all the time, I'm very impressed.
It's pretty good stats, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are definite favourites. I mean, sometimes there is a bit of a running joke of, well, what if we make something really nice?
Yeah.
And then will we never have it again? But I always say to people, I'm not so rigid in this cooking different things that I won't ever repeat something.
Yeah.
Like if there's a really nice dish that everybody's enjoyed.
Has there been... What's one of your favourites?
Well, I suppose, again, a variation on a roast chicken. I suppose that could be considered a repeat.
Yeah.
There is a dish, actually, that I made recently that I hadn't made for probably 8 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
And... it was a real favourite, and it was, again, Delicious Magazine. I feel like I need to credit them with some of my cooking enjoyment. And it was using leftover roast chicken and making it into a pie, but it was interesting in the sense that the pie was curried parsnip and chicken pie.
Ooh.
And so the sauce is, you know, again, not complicated. The sauce is made out of a base of like a curry paste, either one you can make your own or out of a jar, with coconut milk, coriander, and you add your parsnips, your roast chicken leftovers, and some green beans, and you cook all of that down, and then you top it with whatever pastry you like. I use a short crust for this one, and cook it, and it's delicious. And it's a really different take on a pie because of that sort of curried element to it. But that was a real favourite, and I don't know why I hadn't made it in so long.
Sounds like a good leftover turkey.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so I made that just after Christmas, because I thought, hang on, I've not had that for so long.
Yeah.
And I had some parsnips from the allotment as well.
Nice.
And so I thought, actually, I'm going to make this again, and it really was as good as I remembered it. Try not to break into the Spice Girls song.
So you mentioned your allotment.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that? I love in the summer when you're there regularly and posting about everything.
Yeah, I know. This time of year is a little bit bleak for it. But I mean, there's still things growing there now, which I always find amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was one of those things that, a bit like cooking, really. I hadn't ever had anybody in my family who had allotments or who had gardening experience, really.
Okay. That's unusual. It's normally like passed down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my granddad on my dad's side was a really keen gardener, but really just flowers. Mm. And in his back garden, he wasn't an allotmenter. But it was one of those things that I probably wouldn't have ever thought I would be interested in. Like if you'd said to 20-year-old me, like you'd really enjoy gardening. I mean, I was a bit of a nerdy square, but even then I would have thought, really? I couldn't picture it. And it wasn't really around the time that allotmenting was sort of on the up in terms of being this, like,
it's very trendy now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it wasn't trendy when I got my allotment. But I think it was just, we lived in a flat in Manchester. We didn't have any outside space. And I think when you're then working Monday to Friday, you realise that having somewhere to be outside at the weekend is a real bonus. And so we signed up for an allotment expecting to have to wait for years, because even though it wasn't a really trendy thing to do, there were still waiting lists. And I think if we'd waited for one in Chalton or Didsbury or places like that, there would have been a long wait.
Yeah.
But one came available in East Manchester in Abbey Hay. And we went to look, and they had some plots that were overgrown and unloved that they were wanting people to take on, but they also had a patch of tarmac at the end of the run of allotments that I think they'd wanted to use as a car park. And we said, well, you know, what are you doing with this space? Could we take this on and turn it into an allotment rather than it being used as a car park space, so that we could start from scratch?
Yeah.
And we knew that we wanted to have beds. So, you know, again, that's an advantage, being able to put the beds on top of this surface. So they said, yeah, and you can have that straight away. And so that's we thought, amazing. Well, this is the balance between, it gives us a degree of being able to control what sort of allotment we have, but also we can get it now. And mm-hmm. we wanted to start now. And I think if we'd waited maybe a year or two, perhaps that enthusiasm would have passed. Mm-hmm. So we took this allotment on, and we built raised beds and ordered a ridiculous amount of topsoil to fill these raised beds. Mm-hmm. And probably questioned what we were doing several times during this process, because none of that is growing anything. And I think we thought, gosh, we've done all this work, and what if we don't actually like the yeah. gardening bit of yeah. it? You know, we might have really enjoyed making the beds and shifting all of this stuff. But yeah, we started relatively small, one bed at a time, mm-hmm. and just seeing what worked. And I think, again, like with cooking, there are no hard and fast rules with gardening. I think we realised that you can just be a novice and just start. Because mm-hmm. I think, you know, you can sometimes read books and, you know, even just the back of seed packets and think, oh gosh, you know, I've got to follow these rules exactly. But no, actually, there's so much trial and error, even with experienced gardeners. I mean, the thing with getting an allotment is there will always be people to offer you advice.
Yeah.
And it
nice
might be
community vibe.
Yeah, yeah, and it might be 10 different types of advice, which is often the case.
You just have to figure out your way.
Exactly, but what yeah. that shows you is that everybody's got their own way of doing it. And once mm-hmm. you realise everybody's doing it their own way, you realise, well, hang on, there can't be these fixed rules mm-hmm. if 10 different people are doing this 10 different ways.
Yeah.
And you also realise that even really experienced gardeners have terrible years for certain crops mm-hmm. because actually you can control only a small amount of it as a gardener. You can plant the seeds and you can keep your soil healthy and tend to the plants once they're growing. But things like weather,
yeah.
that can make or break a crop for a whole season, and you have no control over that. So
don't be disheartened.
Yeah, exactly. And I think to anybody thinking about doing it, is just start, and mm-hmm. start small. I think what a lot of people fall down on is they see like an overgrown allotment that they take over and they feel overwhelmed and they don't know where to start. And we would
just
always
grow a couple things.
Yes. Yeah, clear a space a couple of meters across, even if the rest of the place yeah. is like waist high in weeds, clear one bit, put something in, because once you see something growing, that enthusiasm for doing more of that mm-hmm. really takes you. And so that's what gets you through tidying the rest of a massive plot that's not been loved for years, mm-hmm. or building, you know, beds for days on end. You know, once you can see that satisfaction of putting something in the ground and feeling like, oh, I've made this.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I really yeah. recommend it to everybody.
Yeah, I definitely want to start, and I like grow herbs and like little bits, and
yeah.
I did Cavolo Nero this year.
It's such an amazing crop,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. It's like lasted all winter.
And it's actually relatively expensive, I think,
yeah.
as a crop in yeah. the supermarkets. If you were yeah. to buy it from the supermarkets, and particularly because I think Cavolo Nero is seen as the fancy kale, mm-hmm. it's even more expensive than just regular curly kale.
Yeah.
And so if you can grow it yourself, it's literally food for free.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it's very cool. I always am impressed by your squashes.
I think they're one of my favourite things yeah. to grow. I think there's something almost like fairy tale about growing yeah. squashes, isn't there? And they're so hardy. I mean, we try to grow everything organically. We're not massive weeders. We don't spend hours weeding. Mm. So at certain times of the year, you know, our plot is functional rather than looking really great. Mm-hmm. But things like squash, you plant them, and once they're in the ground, you can leave them.
Wow.
And they will just do their thing. And I'm sure that there'll be squash experts out there saying, no, you do need to look after them really well. But in my experience, they can be left.
Oh,
and
okay.
they're great ground cover because they grow so vociferously that their leaves will give great shade mm-hmm. to the soil. So that means that you're not getting weeds all over the bit that they're covering. It means that towards the end of the year, when other things that you've had growing through summer are starting to die back, that there's still some greenery and life on your plot. And then it's just like magic, like hunting through for how many squash you've got. It's amazing.
Love it.
And they store really well, which is also an advantage. So I've still got a couple of squash that I grew last autumn.
Wow.
Still to use this
That's
year.
Cool.
Yeah. And so I think anything that you can grow to like eke out that feeling of freshness in these sort of more barren months.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I find it amazing that things like kale, like it's a leafy veg. And
yeah.
if you, like, not having grown anything before allotmenting, I would have thought that that wouldn't survive the winter, that that would be something that would, as soon as a frost or a cold night hit, that it wouldn't survive.
Yeah.
And yet kale, cavallonero, squash, all those sorts of things are growing when all of the summer crops are finished. And, you know, squash, they do die back in autumn. Once you've had, they've had a frost, their foliage really doesn't last at all.
Mm.
But the squash themselves, once you keep them, store them properly, they will last. And I was at the allotment yesterday, and what's still growing? All of the kales, spinach, which is the finest leaf that you can imagine. And it's there. And I planted that in March of last year. So that's so that's nearly a year.
Yeah.
And it's still growing in the like some of the coldest part of the year. And rainbow chard.
That's very
and parsnips.
Cool.
And so it's just that I would have thought that through the winter, you know, as a naive non-gardener before getting an allotment, nothing really grows.
Mm-hmm.
But it does. There's so much life there. And I think that's nice to be able to see, sort of particularly in December and January when things are a bit bleak and that post-Christmas sort of depression hits everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to see that there's something still going on there and that something that's like preparing for the next season. You're always looking forward. So
I love seeing all the bulbs coming through as well.
Yes, and they're doing that now, aren't they?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's always like, oh yeah, spring is coming.
I know. And I think if you're outdoors, whether or not you're gardening, I don't think you can ever be sort of feeling too stuck in the moment, because there's always change. Like even if you just go for a walk around where you live,
mm-hmm.
like within a week you'll be seeing things change already.
Yeah.
And I just love the positivity of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, I need to get my green fingers going. We've got some raised beds coming for our out the back.
Well, you're always welcome to come down to the allotment and have a bit of a potter around and see what you might like to grow.
I would love that. Do you have a greenhouse as well?
We do. We have two. I know. It's one of those things that it's very easy to become not obsessed but just really curious as to what you can actually grow.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a couple of years now where I've grown cucamelons, which are from Mexico,
yeah,
and you wouldn't think would grow in the East Manchester weather conditions, but in a greenhouse they do.
Wow.
And
what
just,
are they?
So they're about the size of an olive.
Uh-huh.
And they're, I mean, as the name suggests, they are from the cucurbit family.
Mm-hmm.
So inside they have a sort of seeded, fresh, quite watery inside, like a cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
But their skin is a bit sweeter. It has almost like a zing of lime to it.
Mm.
Great for like putting in a gin and tonic.
Ooh.
Or serving in a salsa, or just eating like as a little nibble.
Nice.
But yeah, just things like that you can grow in a greenhouse that you would otherwise wouldn't. I mean, I've never seen a cucamelon available to me to buy in the shops. So I'm sure there are places that are selling them, but not locally to me. And so chilies have been a real sort of source of interest for us, which is why we have two greenhouses, because
mm-hmm.
we can just grow a huge amount of chilies, like loads of different varieties.
Cool.
And every year we sort of think, well, what should we try this year? How hot should we go on this one? What's a really...
Have you done like an ancho chili?
Yes.
Is that naturally smoky when you dry it, or is it...
It has a degree of sort of... It has a depth of flavour to it that
mm-hmm.
isn't as fresh and zingy as some of the other South American chilies.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it gets its true smokiness from either drying it out or charring it like before you cook it.
That's my favourite, I love it.
Is it? Jalapenos have been our real success this last year, because I think previous years we'd had sort of a few and they'd been relatively successful but didn't really have much heat. And the ones this year have got real heat.
Nice.
And I think, you know, I'm used to eating jalapenos quite thickly sliced.
Mm-hmm.
Thinly sliced, they're just so fruity
mm-hmm.
and hot, really hot. But yeah, so we grow probably about 10 or 12 maybe more varieties of chilies.
Oh, that's cool.
But you can keep them in your freezer and so, you know, have a stock of them.
Mm-hmm.
I always think using like your kitchen in a way that serves you like throughout the year, like have a stash of fresh chilies in your freezer, like grate up your ginger and have it stashed in your freezer
mm-hmm.
so that it saves time later.
Or it's got
things
a
like
knob
that.
Of ginger hiding in the freezer.
Exactly.
Because you can just grate it straight from frozen. And
exactly. And all those sorts of things that I think are things that lurk at the bottom of people's fridges and get thrown away because they've gone horrible.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other food waste tips?
I think the planning is a big part of it,
yeah.
because I think it's like before I was so consciously planning what I was going to eat. I think I would get to the end of the week and realise that there were lots of things in my fridge that I hadn't used and that were past their best, mm-hmm. or that I'd forgotten about because, you know, you fill your fridge mm-hmm. and you can't necessarily see everything you've got in there. And if you haven't thought in advance what you're going to be eating for your dinner and you don't see that, it stays at the back of the fridge, forgotten about. Yeah. So I think planning is a really good tip. But also, like, midweek, have a look through your fridge. See what's there that you might have forgotten about. See what's there that needs using up by a particular date.
Mm-hmm.
Use your freezer space if you're lucky enough to have one, because I think even if you can't use something immediately, you can probably...
Most likely freeze it.
Yeah, most likely freeze it or cook it, blanch it, freeze it, and then think about it later.
Mm-hmm.
And so my planning goes to the extent of having a freezer list.
Nice.
I have a bit of...
I wish I was one of those people, because I lose a lot of things in my chest freezer.
One of my aunties, she tells that she's an amazing pie maker.
Mm-hmm.
And so she would have days where she would make loads of pies and put them in the freezer. But she'd make sweet pies and savoury pies. And she always used to enjoy telling us the story about how she'd got what she thought was a steak pie out of the freezer and had cooked all of the sides and the gravy, and it turns out it was an apple pie.
Oh, no.
And so good freezer labelling is a really good thing.
I can't work out which way's worse.
I know. Custard on your steak pie is probably pretty disgusting.
I think that's worse.
Yeah. So I always think if you can be organised, and again, knowing what's in there, but also... seeing what's in there, like on a piece of A4 that you just stick with a bit of blue tack on the inside of your freezer door, and you can cross stuff off with like a Sharpie as and when you're using things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're ever thinking, oh, I don't really know what we've got in or what needs using up, and you can see, and so if you've put leftovers in there and you've got, so I've still got some Christmas ham in there, and I've got some of the Christmas turkey in there, and I'll use that another time. But if I hadn't written it on the door, it's very easy for a small packet of that all wrapped up to probably be forgotten about at the back of the freezer. So I think that's just knowing what you have, not buying too much,
mm-hmm.
and using what you have across more than one meal.
Yeah.
So things like the chicken, where you can get a couple of meals out of it and then make your stock and then
make
use your
stock, guys.
I know. It's, I mean, even if you just don't drink it out of a bowl like I do, like a glutton. But yeah, it's amazing in so many dishes, and it adds such a nice richness of flavour. And it means that you get four or five like things out of one chicken. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
Yeah,
I just marvel at the things that if you plan, if you think ahead, and if you can cook a few different things, that you can really make things spread across so many meals. And I love a bargain, so I love it if I feel like I've saved like a bit of money.
Definitely.
Yeah. So
I love like talking about squash. I always save the squash seeds. I've not nailed like roasting them.
Yeah.
I always use them in a stock.
Yes.
And they add such a good flavour.
I think the key to getting a nice crispy sort of snacking squash seed is really drying them out.
Okay.
Because depending on what type of squash it is, because some squash, you cut them open and it smells so much like either a melon or a cucumber because they're quite moist squash, I suppose, whereas others are quite dry and... better for roasting and things like that. So if you've got seeds out of a squash that is actually quite a water-based squash, then really drying out the seeds in a low oven before you then toss them in some oil and then put them in a higher heat oven really crisps them up. They're very Moorish.
I've tried so many times and they've always just been a massive failure and gone in the bin. So,
but at least you've tried.
At least I'm trying. Yeah, okay. But I'm going to try pepper soy. So what is it about cooking for love that you enjoy, or what's cooking for love to you?
I think it's feeding people. As much as I enjoy cooking for myself and I really love eating, I think it's that feeling that you get when you have nourished somebody else. And I really love feeding people in a family style where you've got dishes on the table that everybody can help themselves to. And I just
That's
love
my style as well.
Yeah, and I love seeing people's enthusiasm and excitement and just enjoyment of that. So I think, you know, sitting at a table where you can see people eating your food appreciatively,
yeah,
I think that really just warms my heart. I just love that thought that you've made that experience, and you know,
forms
I think
connections as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you're cooking or eating with other people, it's a real opener to conversations.
Yes, yeah.
And whether that's about the food or about yourself or about, you know, you can have really quite deep conversations over food
mm-hmm.
that I think you wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah.
And it's like you've opened up without realising.
Yes, definitely. Just like brings barriers down.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's that shared experience, isn't it? And mm-hmm. so if you can share something, like particularly if it's something somebody hasn't had before,
yeah.
or I really love it if you make something for somebody that they haven't previously enjoyed. Or so my mum will always say that she doesn't like eating fish
mm-hmm.
and she never cooks fish because she thinks she doesn't like eating fish. If I cook fish for her, she eats it and says at the end, "Oh, I really enjoyed that." And she said, I need to learn how to do that myself. And I'm not doing anything complicated
yeah.
to it, but she would never make that for herself mm-hmm. because she thinks, I won't like that. And so she wouldn't invest that time and energy to make it in case she doesn't like it. But
yeah.
somebody else having made it for her, she really enjoys it.
That's so funny. I love doing that when people, I don't normally like this X vegetable.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
the way you do it, it's nice. Yeah.
yeah.
That's all good.
I make it clear, I don't force people to eat things that they don't like in a bid to convert them. But that again, I think, is the bonus of like serving things family style, is that mm-hmm. if there's something there that people would normally not make for themselves or avoid because they think they don't like it, that they can try a little bit mm-hmm. and there's no pressure to finish all of it.
It's not the whole meal. Yeah.
yeah exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I think growing up where food, you know, you had to finish what was on your plate, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there can be some pressures for people to branch out into new flavours and new food experiences if they feel like, oh, well, what if I try this and I don't like
yeah.
it? What if I've got it on my plate and I can't finish it? And so mm-hmm. I always think, you know, I'd prefer people to try it even if they end up not liking it. There's no pressure to
yeah.
have a whole dish of something.
Exactly.
And eat
That's
it begrudgingly.
It. Yeah, yeah. Aww. No, that's lovely. Yeah, I do love, like, Cooking for Love is about the feeding and
yeah.
about the people. And
yeah. And I was thinking about that actually in the week, and I thought, is there a degree of selfishness to that? Like, do I like it because of how good it makes me feel to feed other people?
Yeah.
But I suppose it's a balanced situation because other people are getting the benefit. It's not just me saying, mm-hmm. oh, look what I've made for you.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Like, there's no truly altruistic
exactly
act, is there?
Yeah.
But I think if you're making people happy and it makes you feel good, it's, yeah, not selfish. Definitely
yeah.
not.
And I think particularly if you're cooking for other people, then you don't mind if you're in the kitchen for a long time
mm-hmm.
because it's all about the rituals and the build up to the event,
yeah.
isn't it? You know, I don't often spend hours in the kitchen if it's just a meal that I'm cooking for myself or ourselves at home.
Mm-hmm.
But I would easily do that if it was a celebration meal or a meal that I was sharing with other people.
Yeah.
Because for me, that's part of the preparation of like the event. Or, you know, I love Christmas and other big events like that because for me it starts in the planning and
yeah.
then the shopping and the preparing. It's the whole ritual for me.
Yeah, I'm like that as well. And I was, this Christmas we was supposed to be away, but then we ended up being here because of COVID. And like a lot of that planning I was like suddenly doing very quickly. I
yeah.
went from like planning to cooking and normally it's done in weeks and
yeah,
what I'm going to do what
the process.
Day.
Yeah.
So that was it's still good. I still got the planning
yeah.
in and it was still good food.
But then
I
think that really
fun.
Though, once you've got yourself that confidence from having done it where you've planned it over maybe days or weeks, then actually if you do suddenly have to plan something like that on short notice,
yeah.
you can do it because you've got that skill without realising it.
Yeah, that's true.
And I just wish that more people would have confidence in the kitchen because I think there's this feeling of, oh, you know, I can't do it, so I don't do it.
Yeah.
And actually it's so easy,
mm-hmm.
so easy. And I know that there's a degree of privilege in saying that because not everybody has, whether it's the money, the space, the time, the
mm-hmm.
emotional capacity, but I think it offers so much to your own life and to the life of those that you share your food with.
Yeah.
That I think it's so worthwhile if you can do it.
And even if you just, like your mum, have 8
yeah.
really nice dishes that suit your lifestyle and
yeah.
you all enjoy, then
yeah.
at least it's home-cooked food.
Yeah, exactly. I know, I was looking back at what things she would make, and, you know, she would make a spaghetti bolognese and it would be with a jar of Dolmio. But that to me was still a home-cooked meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I suppose it struck the balance between busy family life and not perhaps enjoying the cooking process.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still cooked with love.
Yeah.
You know, that was still her nourishing the family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if she found it quite stressful at times, probably because my brother was, like, bottomless in terms of feeding
him.
He'd always be hovering, like,
what
else is there?
Yeah.
Have you finished with that? Like, as a fussy eater, at least she knew that nothing was going to waste when I left it on my plate, because my brother would be hovering. Like, Are you finished? And it would be gone.
That's so funny. Oh, yeah, like, cooking for love, it doesn't necessarily have to be enjoying the food or cooking, but you're still, like, nourishing your family. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think as well, even my bowl of chicken stock with miso soup was me cooking for love, because, you know, when I was feeling like a bit not that great last week and I drank that chicken stock, it made me feel much better.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know, it's a way of nourishing yourself as well as other people, and I want that for more people.
Oh, I think that's a really nice place to leave off.
Yes, we could probably chat for hours,
I know. I say that to everyone because I literally love just chatting about food.
We can have a season two.
Yeah.
Where are they now?
Yeah. At the allotment.
Yes.
Finally.
Yes. I mean, if you'd come down today, it would have been windy and
been
a bit bleak.
Yeah.
But certainly if you come down in like July, you could have a live picking and seeing what's going on.
That sounds fun. Thank you so much for giving me your time on your weekend.
Oh no, thank you for inviting me. I always like talking about food.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Cooking for Love. It was so divine to speak to Pippa. She ordered a lot from me over lockdown and I was making meal kits, and we would have some great doorstep chats, but it was really great to finally sit down inside together and have a proper chin wag. Please follow Pippa on @my_kitchen_year on Instagram. You can also follow me on @cookingforlovepodcast. This is the last episode of this series. I will be back with more amazing guests in May, and if you have any feedback or suggestions for the podcast, I would love to hear it, so please get in touch. Have a good week and see you soon.